You ever noticed the WWE WWF logo is basically a total ripoff of the Wonder Woman logo?
Of the what logo?
Wonder Woman.
Oh, Wonder Woman.
I'm surprised DC Comics hasn't come after their ass. Their biggest star was named Hulk, and they took the Wonder Woman logo. What the fuck? I just wanted to point that out. It seems topical, or maybe not.
Breaking news.
It's so hard for me to sit back here in this studio looking at a guy out here hollering my name when last year I spent more money on spilled liquor in bars from one side of this world to the other than you made. You're talking to the Rolex wearing, diamond ring wearing, kiss stealing, woo, wheeling dealing, limousine riding, jet flying, son of a gun, and I'm having a hard time holding these alligators down. Woo!
To all husbands with the same interests.
It is John Pollock and Court Bauer back with you for another week to chat about all the news that is going on in this very busy industry that we cover. Court, how are you?
Fantastic. It's Friday. We're back with a one-shot. Happy to be back.
This is a super busy weekend coming up between all of the events that are happening from the WWE, Evolve's got shows, PWG has a show tonight. The UK series is kicking off in just a couple of hours. This is one of those packed weekends. The Super Juniors tournament is ongoing. It continues Saturday and Sunday. Wrestling is a very, very time-consuming hobby.
Oh, yeah. And basically, it's on you to cherry-pick what you like because we live in a day where it's all on demand, basically. So you can fast-forward, watch the good stuff, cut out the bad stuff. So if you don't have a product that brings it, from the first match to the last match, you're probably going to have people tuning in and having selective viewing or creative viewing, as we used to call it back in WWE when we'd have to watch other shit, fast forward and find the good shit. And there's a lot of great stuff. There really is, from what Flow Slam's offering to the WWE Network and all points in between. New Japan, they just revamped New Japan World's website. Have you had a chance to look at it?
Yeah, I've looked at the new site. I mean, to me, it's not drastically different from the last one. I mean, I think it's a... They've got an easy button at the top to go between either Japanese or English. I mean, it's to me, it wasn't a drastic change to the layout. Did you find it any easier or more difficult to navigate?
No, I like it a lot. I think having that little English tab there helps a little bit. But I was always using like Google to translate the site anyway, so it wasn't too big of an issue for me. But yeah, I think it's a nice thing to have something a little bit more digestible in general. We'll see if they can grow that New Japan World subscription number in 2017, because they had a little drop off after the Tokyo Dome, which is to be expected. It's like, look at WrestleMania and WWE Network. These things happen, but how can they really increase that number beyond Japan? I mean, it's a very good number for Japan to have the number they have, but how do you get to a larger audience? And are they primed to roll out their project here in the United States? They are. This is the starting point, really, the next 4 to 6 weeks as they go into their first events on the West Coast and how they promote them and what the lasting effect are on the audience, if they like what they see. I mean, they had a big lineup they announced during a Facebook Live press conference they did out on the West Coast yesterday. Did you have a chance to check that out?
Oh, I watched this press conference. It was unique. We had the rollout of all of the announcements. They're going to be carrying the July 1st show live on Access TV and then New Japan World for those without Access. And then the next night, the event will be just on New Japan World. We had Kenny Omega there, Cody Rhodes, the Young Bucks, and then they announced all of the talent that's going to be on this show, including talent from CMLL. The Briscoe brothers are going to be on the shows, and the titles that will be defended. You've got the IWGP title match, IC title, IWGP heavyweight tag titles, and the junior heavyweight tag titles that will be defended over the course of these two nights. And then we got a lot of in-character work from the Bucks, from Cody, and from Omega, which I will say those are four of the few people, I think, that can make kind of in-character stuff in that kind of a setting work, because it does feel somewhat outdated to be going with that approach in a in an environment like a press conference where you're hoping to have media come and cover you, and yet you're not willing to meet them halfway by at least being out of, I don't even want to say out of character, but not so much so fully enthralled as the characters, if you understand.
It felt like maybe if they had had a little bit more time, they could have given the audience or the media theoretically there something a little more. But, you know, because these guys are great with coming up with ideas like the Bucks and Omega. It didn't feel like your typical like Japanese style press conference for New Japan. Like I look at this, maybe it would have been better to do this right after the Osaka show, when you kind of know where you're going with everything and you could do it with the real media there and have that step and repeat behind you. The step and repeat, basically, that's the industry term for the banners behind you in a press conference, whether it's WWE, UFC, and they have the logo and your sponsor's logo and all that stuff. To make it – it really looks professional. It makes it just look like a more photographic, aesthetic, you know, pleasing environment. And I think, you know, doing it in LA is a good idea. There's great media there. There's Vice. There's ESPN. There's local papers like the LA Times. There's local just LA community papers. There's sports media. There's wrestling media. A lot of pro wrestling correspondents are out on the West Coast as well. But I got the impression that like guys like Dave Meltzer were not able to make it because they were notified too late to make it. And kind of, you know, look at the concept of a press conference is to get the coverage, and to get the coverage, you have to solicit the media. And then secondly, you have to go out there and do something that whips everyone into a frenzy. And you know, the card is, you know, impressive. I mean, they have everyone coming from Japan. But I thought the Bucks and Omega almost like it was a decaffeinated version of them is the best way to put it. But, you know, maybe they wanted to play it less, quote unquote, wrestling when they did the press conference and play a little more conservative. You know, there might be a method to the madness.
Yeah, I mean, this wasn't like sometimes the WWE will do these press conferences where it just becomes very awkward when they come out and they're expecting like they're playing to the media as though this is just another wrestling crowd and they're expecting the media to start chanting and cheering. It's like anyone that takes their job half seriously as media is not going to be engaging in chants and playing along like fans. They're there to cover it.
Right.
So, and that's something that repeatedly happens in the WWE, and you get the guys that are commenting, oh, tough crowd. Everyone seems a bit tired here. It's like, no, they're just trying to be professional and cover an event just like they would any other sporting event. Or it's like you're not there to cheer. There's, you know, there's a lot of outlets where if you were to cheer in a press box, you'd be escorted out. And wrestling is kind of not fully made that leap for a lot of people that do cover it. But anyway –
it's one of those things where I think it's like wrestlers can be big personalities, but don't play to the media like they're the crowd. You can be a big personality because it works in the UFC when you see guys like Conor McGregor and others that they don't like cup their ear and go to the crowd like Hulk Hogan, but they do something that gets them ink and gets people to check out the content and sells you on something. So there's a way to do it without looking like a carnival barker.
So some of these numbers that came out from a Takaki Gadani earlier as New Japan was going over their year. They're expecting for this year to bring in $33.3 million in revenue and estimating up to 45 for next year by next summer. So it definitely puts it into focus, Court, kind of the disparity here of where New Japan is in the worldwide market in comparison to a behemoth like the WWE. And New Japan World, also evidence of that. They are now standing at about 50,000 subscribers 2.5 years in, with only 10,000 of that outside of Japan. So, I mean, the popularity of New Japan, I think everyone sees it as something that is at least going upward. But I think you have to rein in expectations when you're making WWE comparisons, which New Japan has kind of invited that comparison by stating that we are going after the WWE. We are going to the U.S. We are going to expand into a much larger global presence. So, I mean, those comparisons are automatically going to be there regardless.
Yeah, it's it's good to say you're in the same conversation as WWE, but the reality is look at the numbers and it tells you where they are really in the market. But you can also look at the numbers and say, hey, look where they were years ago versus where they are today. They're at pretty much at maybe a – they haven't been at this maybe in a decade and a half, about 15 years since they've been even flirting with the performance they are at now. And to say that they've turned this company around in, what, 4 or 5 years to the point they have is phenomenal. I mean, that really – just forget the WWE part of this and competing with them and the dick measuring. The actual turnaround is incredible. And Bushiroad is like the perfect company to take it over because – of what they do and how they their ability to license things, their ability to connect with their audience, and they picked the right guys. You know, if you look at the creative end of New Japan over the last 4 or 5 years, it's been very consistent, and it's been nothing crazy, nothing reactive, but they've been slow and steady, and they've been very consistent with their product, and it's been a fantastic product. So You can't just look at the WWE and you got to look at that and say, hey, you know, they're doing very well now. What's the viability of rolling out and doing something in the States? They did try a sort of kind of do it. It wasn't really the same at the same level years ago in New Jersey and on the East Coast. It was kind of
where they introduced the championship.
Yes, they did. Yeah, they did. Yes. And MVP was the first champion. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what stage two of this project looks like and when that rolls out. And is that something that if it's me, I would say this weekend, this July weekend, when you bring your show here, give us that carrot dangling over us to entice us to come back for phase two. Give us some sort of reveal. Give us something to say, oh, I can't wait until August, September, January, whatever the date is where they do the next stage. Give us something. Give us something impactful so we're not just seeing a standalone show on an island isolated from what's coming next. Hook us and have our money for the next time. It's the old classic get tickets at intermission kind of concept, maybe a little different, a little more refined. But I think it's an important part of this LA swing is to have something like that there to hook you for the next wave and really to keep the product as authentic as possible. We want, just like the Japanese, when an American act goes over there, since the Beatles in the 60s, and they play Budokan, they want the authentic experience. And it's important to have the authentic experience when they come in July. And I think they're working very hard to accomplish that.
Yeah, I really hope that that is the end product, is that when you go to the Long Beach Convention Center, mm-hmm. you can replicate Cork and Hall as much as possible, that you feel you're walking in. Because I think that is the draw for so many people, is that they don't have the ability to go to Japan on a dime, mm-hmm. and you're bringing Japan to them. You're bringing yes. that experience to them. And we've learned this with the WWE going there. It's not catering things to Japan. They want the WWE genuine product when they go to a live event there.
And case in point, when WWE first started to go into Japan, they brought in a Japanese ring announcer. And it's very rare that a ring announcer gets booed by the Japanese audience. They rejected that ring announcer and any Japanese presence on the show. They wanted an authentic American WWE product. So the next tour, they made sure to bring in Lillian or Justin Roberts to make sure it felt like an authentic experience. That's the same thing. The same rule applies here. The Americans, we're not going to want the Americans, the Canadians, whoever comes to the show, they're going to want the real experience. And the experience starts the second you walk in the doors to Long Beach Convention Center on July 1st and 2nd. What's that experience going to be? And one thing, just talking about the press conference, I was surprised someone like Jim Ross wasn't there, because you think about, as a quote-unquote influencer with his social media reach and everything else, and his ability to kind of be a better maybe mediator, because there was someone there that was kind of butchering the Japanese names. I don't know who that guy was that was part of the press conference. Jim Ross would have fit in well because of his experience doing the Access show, and it's Jim Ross. And maybe scheduling wise it didn't work out, but I would say, man, it's maybe worth figuring out a time when you can do it, when you can have someone like Jim Ross there. So
yeah, I imagine it did come down to scheduling, because I know Jim Ross was in LA Monday and Tuesday this week doing the Access voiceovers that that would have been the time to do it. And it would have been, he's already there in the city. And then later in the week, I mean, apparently he was doing the UK voiceovers Thursday. So that couldn't, that would have conflicted with the press conference. But yeah, it seems that had you been able to get all your ducks in a row, that could have worked out for earlier this week.
Agreed. And I think it would have been more impactful. Again, press conferences by design, the concept is to make a big splash. And you want to line everything up. And if they're not lined up properly, you're not accomplishing your mission. And we'll see how it works. You know, this is the beginning of a long journey for them. It really is, as they march to July 1st and 2nd and then thereafter, wherever that takes them.
Where do you see this growing to? I mean, they've sold around 5,000 tickets between the two events. They were scooped up instantly in the two offerings that they had. How big do you look at for a venue the next time around, and where you anticipate demand? Because clearly this one, the Long Beach Convention Center, wasn't big enough. I think you could have sold double the amount of tickets.
It's true. And you could have done – you kind of done a bigger arena, sure. You want to establish your venue if you're going to do repeat business. So you know that's where you go. You know the experience. You know the ins and outs. And so it's important also to be realistic. You know, your first outing, you might have a huge turnout because it's the first time out. But for steady, continual business, I think it's important to have a more realistic venue. But again, that also is determined by, well, what's the concept? Is it if the U.S. New Japan offshoot, is it going to be a mixture of Japanese and American talent? Is it going to be the entire Japanese crew coming over for a few shots a year or tour here or there and everywhere? What is that? And that kind of dictates where you go with this moving forward. And in LA, there's the next step up is pretty sizable. There's a convention center nearby. It holds 10 to 13,000. You think about union labor costs associated with that venue, and doing it for 2 days, the cost involved does add up. I don't know the cost, but typically for something like that it's going to be pretty high.
So they're not running the LA Coliseum, you don't feel?
No, I don't see the LA Coliseum. I don't see the Staples Center. I know they could have gotten a great deal on the LA Forum if they wanted to go there. The LA Forum, believe it or not, is still around. It's actually owned by the good people over at Madison Square Garden. They own a lot of venues throughout the country, and that happens to be one of them. And when I was with AAA, we were actually looking at doing Triple Mania 25 at the LA Forum a year or two ago when looking at, you know, 2 years down the road. But that never came to be.
Also, just finishing up here on New Japan, just going through some of these numbers, they also revealed that they're doing about 200,000 weekly viewers on Access TV. Access, you know, it's not available to everyone in the country. In Canada, it's very, very sparse. I mean, I don't get Access at all. I mean, do you look at that number as a positive, given the platform they're on, that they're doing 200,000 viewers? Or is this something where it's not being maximized?
You got to remember, again, I'm going to bring up Jim Ross's name. Jim Ross, and look at the impact he had on the Wrestle Kingdom show he did 2 years ago. And you look at Access at 200,000 compared to Impact, which is in a lot of more, significantly more households. And yet I still think that's an underwhelming number. I do. And Access, honestly, is not a place realistically they can stay in the long run if they want to be viable. I mean, Access has never been a launching pad for anything. You know, I guess you can make sort of kind of an argument for Strikeforce back in the day, but realistically, there were so many other factors in that one that led to them inheriting the old Pro Elite, Elite XC time slot on Showtime. But yeah, and look at Ring of Honor; it really didn't generate any sizable difference in their business when they were on that channel. So it's a maybe a non-starter channel. I've never been too fond of how they do things over there. So maybe I have a prejudice against them.
Well, you're also it's kind of interesting to compare the two of where you would rather be. Would you rather be a promotion that is on Access, where you have 200,000 viewers, but to me, of those 200,000 viewers, I think you're definitely hitting your audience that you want to, as compared to pop, where I don't think that's a network where you're really gravitating from just the average pop viewer. I don't even know if the term average pop viewer exists in the television lexicon. Like, it's a network that is so far off the radar, and I feel pretty certain that you cannot grow your domestic business off of pop TV, which is in 74 million homes.
Realistically, if there's good wrestling, they're going to find it, no matter the channel. When 1,000 years ago it was UHF, you move your antenna, you find the UHF channel. If it's a Spanish channel, and a lot of wrestling was on Spanish TV, including here in the New York area back in the day, you still find a way to watch it, even if the rest of the content is in Spanish. So it does help if you have a lead-in. The Braves and TBS, it was a love-hate relationship with – sometimes it was a great opportunity on a Saturday. If there was a day game, if it was a night game, you got your TBS cut off or your Saturday night cut off, or if the afternoon game went late, you bled into your time slot, you were screwed. So lead-ins can be great, but if you have a good product, people will find it, especially if you have a marketing or promotional apparatus to help you. That's always going to be the key there. And Jim Ross, with his social media and his podcast that does very well, there's a track record. It's performed rather well in the past. Why now it's not? I'm not sure. And that's no knock on JR. I really don't know. I haven't really examined it too much. But I would say, as a whole, when you think about that package that is New Japan doing 200,000, but it still seems underwhelming to me as a number. And I honestly, I think for this product to grow and not just reach the hardcore of hardcores, which is what the MMA fan that watches Access is, and everything else on that channel is just like concerts, you need to grow and hopefully get a better deal somewhere else. But the problem is the United States landscape is bleak when it comes to people that want to bid on your content for wrestling. It is – I mean, internationally, you're in a lot better position, although New Japan still needs to make some progress there. But internationally, for Impact, for WWE, that's where you're making a lot of money now. Here in the U.S., it's like – it's really hard. It's really hard. And not that you want to ever take a barter deal, but sometimes you got to even look at that as almost like you're lucky to get that. And that's a sad thing. That's a sad assessment of where pro wrestling is, but that's where it is in the United States.
No, it's a great point. Like, the international rights fees are carrying Impact at this point. And, you know, for the WWE being the exception to every rule, they're the ones that can get that 160 million in domestic rights from NBC Universal. But for the rest of wrestling, I mean, you're not sniffing at a figure like that. And so many people in wrestling will talk about digital and online viewership, that's the future, but the money has not caught up to that yet. The numbers have been there for a lot of these companies, but the money is not. And case in point was the WWE. Their digital presence, that is not a money earner at this point in 2017. So it may be a completely conceivable plan for the future, and 5 years from now you can make money digitally, but today it's a big struggle. And especially domestically, the rights fees are not there for non-WWE wrestling.
Yep. And so you have to be realistic about what does the U.S. mean. And yes, there's a lot of merchandise money to be made in the U.S., a lot of exposure. It's a prestigious move to go to the U.S. But in terms of TV rights for TV content for wrestling – it's all companies, whether you're a startup like New Japan will be, or you're Ring of Honor. You know, Ring of Honor has a great situation. They are really set up well, because if you look at Sinclair now acquiring Tribune, they really have a great opportunity in key markets to just continue to build what they have and do a split on the advertising money. So they're in a great stable slot. And that's going to be interesting to see what their story is in 2017, 2018 and beyond, and how they can hopefully – take that to the next level. And that's all hinges on if they want to take some risk, if they can compel Sinclair to give them a bigger budget, and the age old story with Ring of Honor at Sinclair.
Final thing here. I mentioned the fact that Access was doing tapings this week for the New Japan show, and they're trying to get as up to date as possible. They were even calling matches from Dominion this past week. And one of the matches that Josh Barnett and Jim Ross had to call this week was the Okada Shibata match. Mm. And as someone that has produced Talent Court, how do you call that match, and specifically the headbutt spot? Are you calling it in the moment? Do you call attention to how this could have been career ending? I mean, that's a really interesting match to have to call after the fact.
I think you sell the dangers of the spot, you know, and the realities. And this is not ballet, as JR would say, and you really nail the consequences, the impact of it, and call it like a shoot. And then in the aftermath, say, you know, this, you kind of give the context, the framework for what have we just seen, and that, yes, they left it all in the ring, but at what cost? And kind of almost look at it in the way of, this could be the final chapter of Shibata. Will we, you know, and kind of give it that realistic twist. I mean, that's the real story. And sometimes, tragically, the best story is the real story, even though I wish we had never seen that happen.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a really interesting episode to watch, and what kind of the follow-up is after the match, if they're going to update viewers on what happened to Shibata, what his current health is, because that very likely may be the last time you've ever seen Shibata in a wrestling ring.
Yeah, I hope not. Yet at the same time, maybe it's for the best, where I just don't have enough information to know where his health is at. But anytime you talk about brain swelling, bleeding on the brain, it can be scary. But I've also had friends of mine that have had situations. They didn't get headbutted, but they had bleeding on the brain. They were in the hospital for a week or two, and they were able to resume all their physical activity and live a normal life. Will that happen here? I don't know. And, you know, Shibata seems to be, you know, able to walk and function, but any more impact to the brain, the head area, is that going to result in anything else? That's the big question. And it's such a tragedy, because he was phenomenal. He was set to be such a big piece of New Japan in 2017. And I think that plays to the other injuries they've had, and now they're trying to be more cautious. But these guys like Tanahashi, they are so important to the rollout here in the United States, to continue building on the momentum they have, to continue to hit those projections that Kidani wants to hit. There's a lot of pressure on the crew. And a lot of it, you know, the calling card for New Japan is that style, that authentic badass style. But,
well, I mean, Tanahashi is,
yeah,
he's going into Dominion now with a torn biceps. He's going to take this tour off. But I mean, if it's a full tear, that's insanity. That's insanity that he's going to be back in 3 weeks.
And I remember Scotty Steiner way back in the day. He had a similar injury, and he was basically out for like six, seven months. And he was a body guy. I know, everyone knows, right? But at the same time, he was a body guy, and he knew if he wanted to be even remotely close to his physical potential, he needed to take that time away to heal this injury. And Tanahashi, I just think it's. I wish he could take the time. I wish there were – maybe he wouldn't, even if Shibata had not gotten injured and he had all these other issues going on. But you know, there's a lot of pride in that culture when it comes – and it's the old school wrestling culture in general that ties into, you know, you just no-sell and keep on going. The office relies on it, and you don't want to miss that paycheck either.
It's both a blessing and a curse. You never wish an injury on a guy, but at the same time, I mean, New Japan, more so than any other promotion over the last 18 months, has shown an incredible ability to take negatives like the loss simultaneously of Shinsuke Nakamura and AJ Styles, and see the positive in that, in elevating talent to that level. I mean, we just went over the numbers, and they had a better year coming off those losses, where people were very concerned about the immediate future of New Japan. And similar here, I feel that New Japan they're nimble enough in their booking that they can take that a loss of a Tanahashi at least opens up a spot. And realistically, there's two major stars at this point that in Shibata as well, that you have that ability to maneuver other talent to those spots and come out of this okay. I don't know if that show necessarily falls apart next month because Tanahashi is off, and then you have the comeback where you have a healthy Tanahashi.
there's a lot of money in a comeback, and that's what I hope for with WWE and Braun Strowman, is that they hold him off, even if he can come back in 6 to 8 weeks. I don't want to see Brock versus Braun this soon. I'd rather see it at WrestleMania New Orleans, and you know, hopefully it changes the landscape for WWE. For New Japan, it is what it is. They're culturally not quite there where they're going to let a guy rest up, but I think it would open those doors for guys to come up, whether it's a Goto or anyone else, and emerge as a higher figured guy in the main event equation. And you know, on the flip side, they also got to be looking at Kenny Omega's contract and trying to engage him soon to re-up before you get into that weird period where he can technically play the free agent market, which is to his advantage. But if you can get him to lock in at a certain rate now, why not? But
I don't see how you can go into Dominion and the G1 unless you know exactly where he's going to be a year.
Exactly. That's the thing. It's like you just can't wait until January and maybe around Wrestle Kingdom you do something. It's problematic. It really is unless you do it now.
Like one-year deals, there's no promotion that is hurt more by a one-year deal than New Japan, because it's all so long-term that you're laying all of this out. You dictate your entire year so many far months out at this point that you can't be just booking the G1 and hopefully this guy will be around in 12 months.
Yeah, I mean, the road to Wrestle Kingdom really starts this summer. And if you don't have your guy at least figured in, yes, I guess you can say, hey, he can lose and he moves on. That's what AJ did. That's what Nakamura did. But to have that question mark and have to wait 6 months or so, especially when you think about this other wrinkle in the whole thing with their expansion to the U.S. Like Kenny Omega is such a big piece. He's the centerpiece in a lot of ways to their U.S. expansion, because he could be big business in the United States and really hold this thing down.
Oh yeah, like his leverage. Talking about that press conference, I mean, the in character part, like his presence is incredible,
right?
And there's so few guys with that level of that swagger, that presence that Omega possesses. But you look at just like, if I knew today this guy's not sticking around, it changes all of my plans, where maybe you still go ahead and Omega ends up with the rematch with Okada, but it's not happening in 3 weeks. It's happening at Wrestle Kingdom next year, and Okada's winning that match with the One-Winged Angel, and that's the end of Omega. I mean, you could change all of your – like, I wouldn't give that rematch away now if in fact Omega is leaving. I would maximize that rematch to be the final note on his New Japan run.
Yeah. Yeah. It's – a lot of question marks about New Japan. A lot of exciting things about New Japan, too. They have – I mean, you look at that roster, and they are stacked. They really are still stacked. With all this stuff going on, they're still a very stacked roster. But if they do some sort of split, equate it to a brand split. If they were to split it and have a crew here and a crew over in Japan, then they're really thin when these kind of situations come up. We'll see if they even go that way. We have no idea what the configurations will be for the U.S. versus Japan. A lot of question marks.
By the time people are listening to this, the U.K. special may be over, so we don't have to do a big preview. But thus far, they've kind of been secretive on what the future of this is. This is this 90-minute kickoff special, and they haven't even announced yet if it's beginning weekly as of today, if this show is coming back next Friday, if it's going to be a break until – are they still shopping this around? Even what the length of the episodes are going to be. But we've got a 90-minute special today to set up the title match for Saturday at TakeOver.
Yes, and I'm really excited to see Jim Ross back on WWE Network, back on the WWE airwaves. I wish he had never gone away, but I'm glad to see him back. And if actually you think about it, JR is going to be on the WWE Network today and also Access TV tonight.
Yeah.
You know, how many times can you say a broadcaster, a play-by-play guy has done that in wrestling, and specifically when it comes to the WWE? So that's probably a first, and it's pretty cool. And I'm really excited to see the network and see where this show on the network goes. And like you said on the last Bauer and Pollock, where they end up in the UK? Is it ITV? Is it elsewhere? Interesting.
still very much open-ended in terms of where this show ultimately lands, because I think the WWE, as we were just talking about foreign rights, that would obviously be their priority, is getting a significant contract for this UK special, as opposed to just being exclusive to the network. I think it would be great for all parties involved if you could get on, especially a major broadcaster in the UK like an ITV.
Yes. And ITV would be phenomenal. Of course, I am concerned about the impact of the WWE and their ties to the UK. It could be a bad situation if they fuck up that ecosystem over there. There's so many cool things happening in the UK. If they get too predatorial with this, it could be catastrophic.
What has your interest this weekend? We have both TakeOver and Backlash coming at you from the WWE. Those are the two major shows of the weekend. What have you thought of the promotion of each respective show?
Not a fan of the Backlash logo, but I am a fan of the Shinsuke Nakamura push. I think that they've done a great job in setting the table for his debut and making him feel like a big star. The rest of that build when it comes to Backlash is pretty unspectacular. We truly do live in a auto renewal era with the WWE network, where this was a pay-per-view.
The auto renewal era.
Yeah, it doesn't really flow, does it? But at the same time, WWE does not have to rely on a legitimate pay-per-view like they would 3-4 years ago to carry this to the promised land. They really don't. And so this is Exhibit A, that they really don't need to carry a big time pay-per-view. And it's sold out. It's Chicago. It's always going to probably be a hot market for them. And we'll see. It'll be tested on Sunday with Jinder Mahal and Randy Orton in that main event. I think it'll probably be one of the better Jinder Mahal matches, because you have Randy Orton in there. He won't be probably doing any dives, but there'll be a few headlocks. And we'll see what that leads to. I got to think Jinder's going to walk away with the title. I just, for some reason, I got to feel like if they don't go there, where do you go with Orton as champion? I mean, I would never have taken the belt off of Bray Wyatt to begin with, but they did. And where's this destination taking us? Where is SmackDown going? Because that title, which is the original WWF title and its legacy and lineage going back to the 60s, is a prestigious belt, but boy, they are risking making this title feel really downgraded if they continue to make it feel so lackluster. And if they do give it to Jinder, I see the creative value in Jinder being champion, but he's not quite ready for this slot. And it can be, you know, maybe it's old school, old fashioned me to say, well, you got to protect the belt. But I think it's a little too early to go there with him as champion. Yet I don't know what you do if Orton is still champion. Where does that take you? I do think we're getting ready for a great run with AJ and Kevin Owens. I think that's going to be amazing. You know, and Kevin Owens is so likable too. Even though he tries to be a heel, you see him on that Finn Balor 24 special. He's so likable. He's such a babyface. I'm like, oh man, he just turned babyface. I don't think they meant to do that, but he's an awesome babyface, because in real life he is.
He'll have a great babyface run way down the road at some point. That's definitely an avenue for him.
Big time.
At some point. I agree with that. Yeah, I feel similar, that they're probably going to go with Jinder winning the title here. And I think they're going to have a lot of – they have an upward battle on Sunday, because I feel if you're doing that title change, that match is going to close the show and you're following a lot of big stuff. The crowd might be spent after the Nakamura match with Ziggler. Mm-hmm. Say nothing of Owens and Styles, depending how much time they get and what kind. If that feud is continuing, they might do, they might not do the full match between those two. But still, it's going to be a lengthy show. And like, I'm just looking here objectively. Like, Jinder has not been able to show me anything in this past month that this jump is, and nor should he necessarily be expected to be ready. This feels like such a knee jerk push. Like, this guy at WrestleMania was doing comedy, getting eliminated by Mojo Rawley, who was the focal point of that match. Like, at least if you knew where you were going, you've got a SportsCenter moment here with Gronkowski. How can we position Jinder Mahal to have some steam coming out of this? They had no plans for him on that day. That battle royal was all built around Mojo.
Yes.
And look where each is now, some 7 weeks later.
And it's one of those things where that really – we all were ready for that Andre the Giant Battle Royal to be kind of like a New Age Money in the Bank. Never the spectacle or the awesome match it was on a WrestleMania card, but the coronation of a guy that was maybe a mid-carder or a great prospect to the main event level. And we thought that would happen with Cesaro, who then was packaged with Heyman, and then they went nowhere. And over the years, you see it time and again, whether it was last year and you see Baron Corbin, and this year the direction they took, it hasn't been that launching pad, which is unfortunate, but could have been, and everyone wanted it to be. And Andre and rubbing him up against something like this should mean something, and it's just been an afterthought, and they haven't thought it out. And again, things change so often in WWE that you could be on your way to a TV that night thinking this is what we're going to do, and get to TV and Vince decides to do something else. And it sounds like a cop-out, but that's, in fact, a lot of what happens.
Yeah, I mean, you know, hindsight's always 20/20, but that Battle Royal, you could have put some stakes on it this year because of where you were going and had Jinder win that, and you get a title shot coming out of it. It immediately would have placed emphasis on this. That Battle Royal was also airing on the USA Network, so it wasn't just some throwaway WWE Network kickoff match. There was a lot you could have done there, I feel, but I think just based on the fact that Jinder got drafted to SmackDown and lost instantly, I think you knew that this was just one of those calls where one day they decided they were pushing Jinder after he was ice cold the day prior.
And I think there's a lot of merit to pushing Jinder Mahal. I don't want that to be mistaken, that I don't think just because the timing isn't right, they're hot-shotting him. And that's a disservice to Jinder and the attraction they're trying to create. I would have honestly had him in the background is Randy Orton is doing something else this summer, and really in September be ready for that and really just build up his resume and his credibility. And so much of the illusion is tied to credibility. Yes, it's a fake sport. It's all work, but making it feel perception-wise is credible, is so
critical.
Look
at Braun Strowman. Had they had the usual mentality a year ago that, oh, big guy, let's just put him in a main event title match, he would have flopped a year ago. He would have totally fell on his face. Mm-hmm. And instead, they went the slow route. And by the time he was able to be moved up, and he was slowly moved up the tiers until he got to a main event level and was accepted at a main event level, he was that much more ready because he had 9 months of them grooming him for that spot, and he rose to the occasion during those 9 months, and he is completely accepted in the main event mix today.
Yeah. And again, it's a lot of it has to do with being consistent and being committed. And whenever they're committed at WWE to something, it typically gets over. Not all the time, but most of the time. And the best example is two examples: Shawn Michaels chasing the boyhood dream, all that shit, and then the Stone Cold push, which they knew was going to be a major babyface, but they had to get him hot as a heel first. And that was like an 18-month commitment. And I don't even think you need that with Jinder to be a viable heel for them. And I think he can rise to the occasion, but they're doing him a disservice.
Let's also chat about GLOW. Netflix has released a trailer for the upcoming series, which is coming out June the 23rd. Mm-hmm. Features Alison Brie, Marc Maron, Awesome Kong, and in a tie-in to the original GLOW series, it is Chavo Guerrero Jr. who is training all of the women.
Yes. I think, you know, Marc Maron's going to be fantastic in the role. It was weird, though, because I was expecting more of a 80s sugar-coated visual for this, and it was a little dirty and grimy. They look at the ring and that where they're training and stuff, and I know you're trying to make stars, and you know, you're showing them at the lower levels, and it's kind of like that Bad News Bears dynamic, dated reference, but at the same time, I thought that the humor clicked. I thought the story's cool. I'm looking forward to seeing it drop June 23rd. I think
I just love that when it came to recreating Dave McClain, Marc Maron was the guy they ended up with. Like, could you think of two more drastically different personalities?
It's okay. I think he's going to actually really help make this thing.
Oh, I think he's going to be great on it. I mean, I'm looking forward to this series.
I mean, it's not exactly the Vince McMahon screenplay where it's like, whoa, what are they doing here? And we'll see. Maybe Marc Maron will grab someone's crotch. You never know.
Linda McMahon is not too optimistic that movie is going to see the light of day.
No shit. File that under no shit. I wouldn't think she would be. And I still think there's a great Vince McMahon movie. I think we all listening and on this podcast know there's an awesome Vince McMahon movie, a Vince McMahon HBO series. You can do it all. But this isn't it in its current version. And, you know, they're going through a creative process and then they're going from draft to draft to draft. Maybe we'll see it. And if so, I suspect we won't have such a frisky Linda.
You would know this better than me. I mean, you and Alex had the exclusive with that script getting out. Is it rare for a script like that to get out to the level that this one did? Does that happen quite a lot? Or is it usually... like scripts like that are under lock and key, or it varies.
It varies. I was surprised. I think there were so many resourceful people in pro wrestling because there were so many.
It just seems like so many people I talked to were able to get this script. And,
yeah, I mean, it's just we just happened to hit the podcast airwaves before they did, but. People from since that podcast have shared their scripts with me, and I'm like, oh my god, this is a totally different draft. So people are getting different versions and stuff, and that happens. I mean, when you have something that's hot and people want to read it, it happens all the time in LA. How publicized it gets depends on the subject and how controversial. If it's just an awesome, well done piece of work, then it doesn't really. I don't think there's going to be much chatter. It's like everyone just says it's really good. It's very buzzy. Can't wait to see it. You know. Shot and put into production. If it's a shit show, you're probably gonna have the Hollywood Reporter or something documenting like this is a really troubled or plagued script, and Warner Brothers is trying to continue to fine tune it, but it's all systems go. You know, those kind of articles come up all the time.
Impact announced on Thursday that they have signed Kongo Kong, Diamante, Anthony Mayweather, the former Crimson. Wilcox, who you would know as Jack Stane, Matt Sydal, Ava Story, and Desmond Xavier to contracts. I think the ones that stand out for me, I think Matt Sydal is a huge pickup. He had an excellent match on TV a few weeks back with Eddie Edwards. Desmond Xavier is someone who hasn't seen a big national spotlight yet. I think he's a great addition to the X division. And personally, I first saw Kongo Kong about 4 years ago, wrestling live, and I think he's just a breath of fresh air. He's something different.
Yes.
And I've enjoyed him so far, just doing the quick squashes, and I think it's just something that it's...
he's a throwback. Yeah, different. It's like what worked with Umaga. It's a throwback. You can't have a bunch of them, but one on your roster, and if you keep him a monster, and they are protecting him, and Dutch and the whole crew there is doing a great job, he can stand out, and I like it. It's so different than everyone else, and wrestling now more than ever is so focused and fixated in the pretty people, and you know, so many wrestlers look like underwear models, and so when you have a guy gnarly and big and his boobies are flipping and flopping, it's kind of cool to have a guy that looks different, to have a monster and have a guy, and he can go. He's not just a guy just lumbering around. He can fly. He can go. He's a good athlete. I think he's a great get. I thought all those guys that they got were solid gets.
Yeah, at the moment with Impact, I'll say on Thursday night, there was an excellent Ultimate X match with Loki and Andrew Everett and Trevor Lee. I thought it was one of the better Impact matches in months. The big downside, I feel, is this show is, first of all, there are way too many authority figures. That point has been beaten to death. But there are so many titles on this show with the injection of Global Force Wrestling that I, as a viewer, I have no idea why Global Force Wrestling is on this show. There is no story behind this. There's no invasion. It's just these titles are here now, where our Impact Tag Champions are now in a tournament for these other vacant tag titles.
Well, if you take a step further back, you can point to every major company, and there's too many fucking titles. You look at WWE. They have two brands with two separate listings of titles. And then actually they have NXT. There's three, and there's so many. There's two world champions on WWE programming. There's two women's champions. There's two tag team champions. Then there's a cruiserweight champion only on one show, which makes no sense. And then you have NXT. Then you look at New Japan. How many fucking titles do they have now? They have more titles than wrestlers almost, and they have a stacked fucking roster. Ring of Honor now has a trios title. I mean, there's like every company has, to me, way too many titles. It dilutes the attraction of having the world title that everyone wants, that everyone's coveting. That is a big problem in pro wrestling, and it's not just Impact. It's everywhere. And I sense with Impact that you're going to eventually have all these titles, their top title unify, kind of like what they did in 94 with WCW, where you had the International WCW World Champion, which was such an odd title, just for a title. And you had the WCW World title, and they merged that, and then Hogan beat Flair from. So I think that's basically where they're going to go. They're going to just they're going to eat up all those global titles. But in general,
when you don't have titles that are over, though, unifications don't mean
how many
anything.
Titles across the board are really over. I mean, I think New Japan's done a great job with their top two titles. WWE, they're really trying to get that Universal title belt over. Brock having these big lulls in between his appearances without Heyman keeping it fresh in our minds is hurting it a bit. We talked about the WWE title. It goes back to 63 on SmackDown, not feeling so coveted and big time. It's again, you got to make these things feel special, make them feel very prestigious. You watch sports, you see the Stanley Cup, you see these titles that feel like there's a lot of history, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears went behind them, and to win it is a big triumph. And yes, it is. It's just a prop, but it can be the greatest prop, and the illusion can make it the biggest, greatest destination there is in the sport, or it's just a prop. And the more titles, the more props.
There are some great talkers on Impact. Like, they have loaded up on, you know, for so long, everyone used to knock Loki's promo style, and I find it to be, he has some of the best interviews going right now. He just feels like a legit, confident guy in all of these packages that run on Impact. I can say the same about Alberto. I think Conan is tremendous leading the LAX storyline. Like, you have a lot of great talkers in Impact at the moment, and that's, I think, something that you should certainly focus upon. Yeah, a guy like Magnus, I think he's very good as well.
EC3 is
you have to look at your strengths of where other places aren't hitting on.
Honestly, I mean, the product compared to where it was 12 months ago, it's so much better because you have these layers of talent. You have the prospects, you have the established guys, you have your get over guys. I think they've done a great job with the main event guys feeling like main event guys. They've revived some guys that were just doing nothing and made them into something. I think they've reconfigured Abyss and played to his strengths. And the return of Talk About Talker, Joseph Parks, he's very good when he's doing that role. And that, I think, is way better than where he was casted, you know, last year or so. And so they have some great talkers. I think you look at the undercard, Davey Richards and Eddie Edwards, I think they're going to have a phenomenal run this summer. I think that's going to be a fun feud to watch on Impact. So they got great workers. EC3 is a great talker. And, you know, he was able to flip that switch. He could have had a very hokey last week with the James Storm angle. He could have had a very hokey deal there, but then he really switched gears and with that whip and doing that angle, and I thought it was effective. It feels like these guys are Impact guys. Your Trevor Lee's an Impact guy, Eli Drake an Impact guy. They don't feel like they're castaways, like WWE castaways, which is a really important thing that can't be overlooked, because for years a lot of Impact felt like that. And Alberto, by the way, talking about a guy that was in WWE, I think he hasn't looked as big time in a long time, and that's not his fault, but they've done a great job making him feel like a top level guy and how he carries himself and everything. I think they've done a phenomenal job there. It'll be interesting to see where Slammiversary goes and where they go, because that's the first real milestone for them. That's their first pay-per-view under this new ownership. And what's the game plan? It's like it's a pivotal weekend when you think about July 1st and 2nd for New Japan and for Impact, because that weekend really is going to set the tone for phase two of the relaunch for Impact and for New Japan's game plan in the U.S. And so that's a really important weekend.
When you're talking about kind of like a narrower audience, I think that's going to really impact, pardon the pun, Slammiversary, when you've got the second night of Long Beach going head to head.
It is interesting. And
like, what are you more likely to do is sign up for New Japan World to watch that show or drop $35 on Slammiversary? I think it's going to be a very difficult. I think unopposed Slammiversary would have its difficulties. I mean, of getting, it's one thing to attract an audience, and thus far this year, I mean, under the Jarrett creative regime, they've had 10 weeks now on TV. Their viewership's up like 6,000 viewers. So it's largely, you haven't grown the audience significantly, if realistically at all, on pop. How many of those are going to be willing to spend a sizable amount? $35 for a pay-per-view is a lot in our automatic renewal era.
It's an interesting situation as the business has changed and the promoters, the decision makers have made it such a value-driven product. And there was a time when these pay-per-views were going for higher than $35 on a monthly basis for some companies. And to see everything now priced at $9.99, you look at pay-per-view and it's like it's almost a dinosaur. Is it worth it is it worth setting up your own OTT? And going down that road versus, you know, like look at WWE and still Ring of Honor and Impact are going down that road. And I don't know. They're still of the pay-per-view mindset that it's worth doing. It's still, there's value in that and you can make money doing it. I guess Slammiversary is going to be a big question mark, but that July 1st and 2nd are going to be it's going to be a crazy weekend for wrestling fans. You know, usually that's around the period where it's all about UFC. Man, UFC couldn't feel flatter going into July. Whereas wrestling, and it's just in general, most people now are more buzzing about pro wrestling than MMA or UFC. It's interesting. It just feels like MMA has fallen into a lull, and wrestling is like enthusiasm for wrestling is increased.
Yeah, well, that International Fight Week pay-per-view is really going to struggle. I mean, I don't think it was going to do Dynamite numbers to begin with what they had. Mm. There's some really good fights on that card. Yeah. I think Robbie Lawler and Donald Cerrone is a fantastic fight, but you don't have – I mean, they wanted George St. Pierre, Michael Bisping on that card, but they weren't able to land it on that date. They may not land it on any date. So that's – it's unfortunate. That week's pay-per-view is not – seemingly going to be a big one unless they can pull something really big out at the last minute.
No way, Jose. I don't see it. I really don't. And they may need No Way, Jose to actually make that thing do some business or waiting myself to help them pop business because it's just I used to love the July UFC events and it just doesn't have any interest for me at all. It might be the first one I don't watch and I've watched them religiously for years. And you look at last year, how big was that? How much buzz did that have compared to this?
How about, as a former promoter, Court, would you earmark $1 million to lure CM Punk out of retirement?
Well, you are talking to a promoter who didn't probably do such a great job. But CM, it's a great publicity story. It's a great publicity stunt. I don't foresee CM Punk. I don't even know contractually if he could do it because of his UFC contract. But
I don't think he could.
That right there is the issue. And I don't know if still Punk is in a place where he's enjoying wrestling. And it's hard when you've loved it for so long to be in a place where it's like you just need time away and you don't really want to even talk or do anything with it. That's shitty because it's kind of defined who you are. But you have seen Punk get a little more chatty on social media recently, especially Twitter, with his interactions with the Young Bucks and other people. So – I don't know. I got to think hopefully sooner rather than later he actually does – have a real conversation with someone. I don't foresee, you know, this group in England getting anything like that happening. And could they really afford?
I think Five Star Wrestling has gotten everything they wanted out of this.
Yeah.
It was just some discussion. I mean, no intention that this would ever occur. And yet it was a publicity stunt that resulted in as such for the company.
Yeah, and there's two ways to look at that as a publicity stunt. It gets awareness for you, but also do you look any more credible or do you look kind of goofy for doing it?
Maybe they'll walk to the ring with a briefcase, several briefcases.
Was it a five?
Cash.
Was it a five?
Every single week for their weekly shows.
Was it a five-star publicity stunt? Give me a star rating on that publicity stunt.
It was seven figures. Seven stars.
Was it at the Tokyo Dome?
How many stars would you give AAA, you seem very upset about this promotion of a fraudulent mask match, as you believe.
Well, it's actually the top Mexican publication. Basta is it's not maybe the top Mexican publication, but it's a well-known Mexican publication. And they had a headline this week on their front page, I think it was yesterday or the day before, highlighting that Dr. Wagner and Psycho Clown, who are already announced for a mask versus mask match for Triple Mania 25 in August, will put their masks on the line this June 4th at Verano de Escandalalo, which I just butchered, which is the Summer of Scandal in English. It's a multi-match.
Wait a minute. Isn't that a headline from the Washington Post?
Maybe it's their version.
The Summer of Scandal.
Oh, God. Yes. Welcome to the reality that is the United States. But this is a multi-man match with the mask on the line. And they're basically saying, I guess the paper said that they've labeled AAA and all involved as frauds, quote unquote, saying, clearly they have no intent to give the fans the commitment of a mask being lost in June by either man. So why are they in this match? Because you know, obviously it does take a lot of the air out of the tires if you were to do it on a June 4th smaller end show compared to the big, large Triple Mania 25 stage in Mexico in late August. It should also be noted Vampiro is the booker and mastermind of this mess. But, you know, on one hand, I look at AAA and you got to give them credit for booking Triple Mania so far in advance that everyone knew the date for months and months and months. And they had their match locked in with both guys signing off on it for months and months and months. You can't overlook that when it comes to AAA. They don't do that very often. And I think that's a big match. This kind of does muddy the waters a bit, but to see a paper down there so outraged by it was kind of surprising, you know, labeling them as frauds. Down there, I mean, they really don't want they really are kind of guardians of the customers when it comes to the press. They don't want they don't want the customers to be fucked over, the fans to be fucked over. So they do get a bit aggressive at times over this kind of thing, which isn't a bad thing to keep promoters relatively honest.
And you also had a note that the brother of Corey Graves is getting into the family business.
Well, he's been working down there in CMLL Arena, Mexico, Sam Adonis, who back in
– I meant more specifically the job of the
– jumping on my shit here. Don't get hot.
Let me just... I feel you were just stomping on my segue here. I had a beautiful one.
Oh, okay. I'll lay out.
Don't get hot.
God damn it. Go ahead.
Sam Adonis, new color commentator.
Yes.
This is news to me.
He'll be part of your network, the Fight Network. He'll be doing the English commentary for Arena Mexico, CMLL, which is great. He's been down there for a bit, and it's cool to see them get some English commentary and be available on the Fight Network, which also has a great app, which I have on my Roku, and has – if you're in the New York area, you get it on Cablevision in the United States, and it's all throughout Canada. So Fight Network, man, I wish this channel was around when I was a kid, man. I would just never go to school and watch this thing from boxing to wrestling, MMA. It's like – I don't know how you do your job, John. I would just fuck around watching TV all day at the office.
Yeah, I actually have a TV here in my office, which is never on. Ever. It's just a big blank screen to match what's going on
in your head?
Inside of my head. Yeah, I was well on the way to making my own insult court. I didn't need any of your assistance with
it. I don't know. We have to get in this rhythm. We don't do this enough, so you know, sometimes we had to jump on each other's shit.
No, we do have pod rust.
Pod rust. That does not sound good.
Well, that's going to end. Actually, let's end on this note. Dana White was on TNT this week after the Cavaliers decimated the Boston Celtics, which they will probably continue for the next three games.
Yes.
And stated to Shaq that the Conor McGregor side of the deal with Floyd Mayweather is done. So now he can begin negotiations with Floyd Mayweather. I would definitely encourage everyone to go to Yahoo Sports because Kevin Ioli has a great breakdown of the financials of the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight to give a more realistic view of what Conor would stand to make, throwing out some hypotheticals of what the pay-per-view would draw, and Kevin's conclusion that we are a long way from this fight being completed, this deal. But at least the UFC and Conor are on the same page for this fight. And now becomes the heavy lifting with Al Haymon and Team Mayweather.
Well, That's a question mark. Here's another one. We'll sign off with this. First of all, Andre the Giant would have been 71 today, which is kind of crazy when you think about it. The guy that's most connected to Andre would probably be Hulk Hogan. And Jimmy Hart said that recently doing media that Hulk Hogan is planning a tour. And he's looking to hit 5 or 6 cities doing some sort of big bus tour. And threw out names like Australia, maybe Germany, England, and it'd be not a wrestling tour like he did in Australia with Ric Flair back in the day.
We're beyond that.
Thank God. But a Q&A where you do autographs, and I assume maybe like a one-man show type configuration. So looks like the brother's going to be hitting the road maybe later this year with Jimmy Hart. I guess we'll see where that goes.
Will those be pre-screened questions?
I heard you're the guy like you do with JR shows. You'll be in the crowd and with the mic and just taking questions from the fans. What could they possibly ask? How could this possibly go wrong?
Yeah, how could this possibly result in a unnecessary clip on YouTube of Hulk Hogan at a Q&A in Dublin?
Well, anyway. Hey, you never know.
Big bus tour. The Lex Express comes back to life here with Jimmy Hart and Hulk Hogan behind the wheel.
I just imagine Jimmy's actually the driver of the bus. The bus is yellow and red. Bruce Beefcake, I don't know if he's allowed on the bus anymore, but you know one of the Nasty Boys at least will be on that bus. Yeah, it'll be interesting. I mean, doing a Q&A could be very dangerous.
Yeah, the future of Hulk Hogan, it's always interesting. I think you and I are on the same page where – I just don't know what necessarily is in it for the WWE to welcome this guy back. But I do believe that if he does come back, he will be cheered wildly when he does return. And that's just the reality of the world.
Yeah. They're the safest landing spot for him. If all the places he could go, it would probably be best for him to go there. The question is, will they take him? Here's another one. Here's a weird one. You got New Japan. They're coming to the U.S. looking for ways to get the word out. Hulk Hogan ties into the New Japan history. They booked Billy Gunn, not probably understanding what the audience wants to see. Is it that big of a stretch that they wouldn't check in with Hulk Hogan to see what the Hulkster would be looking for to do some sort of publicity for them? And if so, what would that look like?
Oh, man. Okada Hogan. I'd watch. I would watch.
I've seen worse during some of those battle royals they do every year. You know, some of the guys they dust off for that. But it'd be weird. But I can't, and for Hogan, it's great leverage for WWE to bring him back. Not saying that any of this is fucking happening. I'm just throwing shit out there.
All right. Well, that's going to wrap up the show. Court, what is going on in the world of MLW?
Well, we got a...
Other than your pay-per-view this Sunday night from Chicago.
We have a pay-per-view?
Yeah, Shinsuke Nakamura's on the poster.
Well, yeah, that's just my logo, but we'll get into that another week. But
that's what the L stands for.
Oh, my God. History in the making, Gary Hart Part 3 just dropped. Matt Farmer and I look back at Gary Hart's time from 1976 to 1982, the emergence of the Von Erich kids, the Great Kabuki's creation, King Kong Bundy's creation, Big John Studd's creation by Gary Hart, along with the emergence of world-class championship wrestling. We go into in depth about payoffs, about the production behind world-class, how innovative it was, butting heads with Paul Vosch, butting heads with Fritz. It's a real badass two-hour show. We highly recommend you check it out. Go to MLWVIP.com, and you just have to pay $1.99 a month to get a ton of content. Kevin Sullivan has a show that dropped this morning talking about his lengthy history with action figures, and there's a lot of great content up there. And you can also go to MLWRadio.com. We have new podcasts out from Bruce Pritchard covering the King of the Ring 1996. We have a new Jim Cornette Experience out, and given everything going on in the world, you can kind of guess where Jim goes with that on this week's show. He also visited Jerry Lawler's new restaurant, talks about that, as well as being inducted into the Memphis Wrestling Hall of Fame. Well earned. And a new Tony Schiavone What Happened When podcast is out, along with the new MLW Radio flagship show. So there's a ton of content over at MLWRadio.com.
I think for part 4 of the Gary Hart special, you should really do some research and see if Gary Hart kept any notes and put them all together as stories and just read them, the entire thing.
Yes, I actually looked into that, and believe it or not, he worked with someone on it. And I actually did try to acquire the rights to that, but he really wouldn't let us buy them, which is weird. His ghost co-author. He just wants to sit on this and wants the book to never have existed, which is really sad. So I'm left with my research, my memories, and my notes from my time with Gary Hart. And Matt's a great historian, but it's too bad that we can't give you the book, because the book for any aspiring booker, wrestler, is the Holy Grail. It's a great wrestling Bible to learn how to deal with promoters, how to develop your persona. And for bookers, it's the ins and outs. And for historians, people that are students of the game, love the history of the wrestling business. It covers the 60s through 2007, basically. It's too bad that book will probably never see a light of day again. I've tried everything from literally trying to cut a check to I have the family's blessing to do it, but we don't have the co-author's blessing, and that's the hold up. And I don't think that will ever change. So it's kind of we're deadlocked, and there's not much more I can do. I wish we could.
Well, that's depressing.
Yeah, well, you went there, motherfucker.
Well, there's nothing depressing up at liveaudiowrestling.com.
Okay.
You can go check out all of our latest shows we have, including a new review away that's out today.
Yeah.
Wei Ting and I reviewed a DDT event from August of 2011, where Kota Ibushi navigates a condemned apartment engaging in loosely defined wrestling matches, all building up to the grand finale against the boss, the evil Michael Nakazawa. You will have to listen to this show to fully appreciate what DDT put together 6 years ago. But that is up there on the site. We have all our regular slate of shows, Review of Raw, Review of SmackDown. Saturday night, we'll have a live show right after TakeOver, running through that entire card. And then Sunday, we'll be up at 11 Eastern after Backlash, chatting that card, and may be joined by an interesting guest. So that is all coming up this Sunday night, 11 Eastern. LiveAudioWrestling.com, and Court and I will be back whenever the bat signal goes up.
Can't believe I called you a motherfucker.